Osiris.
You know, you just convinced me that you were a man very comfortable in your own skin. Because
I am.
It takes balls to say that, and I respect, really a lot of respect, that you would say Hot Streets is your favorite Chicago album. That takes balls.
You know what my second favorite Chicago song is?
Oh, baby, what a big surprise.
Hell fuck no.
Welcome to Discograffiti, the music obsessives podcast that gives freaks like you and me the chance to connect with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with three new episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. I am thrilled to announce that we have partnered with the podcast network Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music. You can check out all their music podcasts at osirispod.com. And in this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on Blood, Sweat, and Tears in a very special Duke 'Em Out episode of Battle Royale. Along with our very special guest, Fernando Perdomo. Over the course of this episode, we reveal the very surprising and well-known female vocalist who was initially supposed to take Al Cooper's place in Blood, Sweat, and Tears before David Clayton Thomas stepped in, the difference between a rock band and a rock brand, and which of us loves and does not love Jaco Pastorius, The Blues Project, Billy Joel, and Chicago's Hot Streets LP. If you're a fan of mano a mano music nerd debate like me, you'll want to turn this free version off right now and opt for the director's cut of this episode on our Patreon page, which features over 7+ minutes of essential additional material, including kick-ass rock nerd repartee I hereby deem unskippable. And you can find it in our Patreon record shop for mere pennies at patreon.com/discograffiti/shop. Or just subscribe for the complete versions of all our shows. Even if you're on the fence, hey, just head over there because it's finally free to become a basic member. Contest alert! Repost our promo the week of this show and tag both the Discograffiti Soldiers of Sound Facebook page and Fernando Perdomo to possibly win one of 5 of Fernando's CDs as either player or producer. Pause the show and do it now before you forget. Coming up, we've got Robert Schneider rating the Strawberry Alarm Clock, an interview with Phil Manzanera from Roxy Music, Kula Shaker, the Lemon Twigs, and the 3 surviving Diedrich siblings rating everything they ever released as one of the greatest bands of all time, bar none, the Free Design. Oh, and Michelle Phillips, along with Mamas and Papas biographer Richard Campbell, rating everything they ever did. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. And away we go then. Welcome to Discograffiti's Battle Royale. Today's episode of Battle Royale, the exhumation, the second episode ever in the Battle Royale series, is Blood, Sweat, and Tears with special guest Fernando Perdomo, genre-bridging badasses or countercultural backwash. In case you haven't heard the initial episode of Battle Royale, this is like an uneasy marriage of queasy listening and Rock Cousteau relocated to Debate Club. The whole enterprise topped with a heaping dollop of sweet, sweet dissent. But this ain't the same stripe of Republican-Democrat dissent capable of inducing vomiting. Nay, this is dissent born of 2 men completely in love with their musical opinions and, crucially, each other. In one corner, at an ever-ballooning 190-something pounds, Dave Gebro, the host of Discograffiti, who believes that Blood, Sweat, and Tears frittered their early promise away in shocking record time, which makes them an even shittier band than if they hadn't released their classic debut out of the gate. In the other corner, at a svelte post-pandemic lockdown weight, we have Fernando Perdomo, a fucking rip-roaring and musician, best known for his work as a producer and session bassist and guitarist. He's one of the guitarists in the movie Echo in the Canyon, where he backed up Jacob Dylan, Fiona Apple, Beck, Norah Jones, Regina Spektor, Brian Wilson, and Cat Power. Also currently, he's a member of Marshall Crenshaw's touring band, of which I am very jealous, 9 Mile Station, Broken Sound, the Appease Perdomo Project, The Dirty Diamond, The Parlophonics, Life on Mars, and 1,000 other side projects. I don't know how the fuck this guy gets to sleep at night. I guess it's the Cafe Bustelo pumping through his veins in place of blood. The man seems to be everywhere at once, with his hand in every aspect of music creation and production, yet somehow he's also a blood, sweat, and tears fanatic. Actually, BS&T apologist may be more apt.
Come on.
Welcome to Discography, Fernando.
Let's do it.
Actually, you've been on the show before, so let's just address this super quick. During the Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime series, which is coming March 22nd, you actually were there to do Zoom.
Yes.
And you became actually a pretty awesome member of the tribe. You pipe in at key moments and dump great statements into the podcast, and I kept
that was a lot of fun, man. It was really, really an honor to, you know, be there with Michelle. I got to work with her in Echo in the Canyon, and she's a fascinating woman, and it was really, really cool to be there in her presence and help her out. You know, it was really cool.
Yeah, it was great to have you there. At first, when you started talking, I was like, oh man, what am I going to do about the audio here? How am I going to figure this? And then I was like, well, you know what? He's piping in literally during the perfect time, saying really smart shit. I got to get this guy on the show. And now you're wearing a Free Design shirt. You're actually responsible for hooking me up. But okay, let's keep focused here. So your accomplishments read like a Torah scroll, an endless, endless array of things, which makes it even stranger to me that your opinions on this band are so foolishly wayward.
Well, here's the thing. You know how people will still be very mushy about stuff that they listened to when they were a kid that made them feel the feels for the first time? For example, people that are still crazy about, you know, Partridge Family or Monkees, or my generation, people that still get mushy every time they hear alternative music. Sometimes you grow out of it, but the thing about Blood, Sweat, and Tears is it was one of the first times I felt chills listening to music. And I still get chills listening to Blood, Sweat, and Tears, because there's something about that combination of the horns, that big voice, the big sound. It just blows me away. And it was also one of my first concerts. So my personal connection to Blood, Sweat, and Tears may be a little bit of a bias because of the fact that as a Cuban kid growing up in Miami, which was not a very rock and roll town, I took what I could get. My influence of Blood, Sweat, and Tears were actually not my parents. It was my high school music teacher, who was a huge fan because he was also a marching band instructor, and he loved horns. His brother was a trombone player, is a trombone player. So I remember him putting on Go Down Gambling from the fourth record and hearing that guitar riff and then hearing those horns come in, and every hair on my body was just on end. And, you know, this is a band that has a visceral effect on me. I live and breathe this music, and it's influenced me in my job because it's influenced my guitar playing, it's influenced my songwriting, it's influenced my arranging. They did a good job of making sure that every arranger was listed on the record, because there had a built-in arrangement situation where guys like Fred Lipsis and, you know, Dick Halligan, they were all creating arrangements for these songs. And the fact that they're credited on the records is proof that arrangement is a big thing, especially when they're doing so much outside material.
Let's talk first about what we can agree on. All right, so we'll start there and deviate wildly from there. So here are the things that I feel like objectively we can agree on. Blood, Sweat, and Tears is one of the first horn-based rock groups, a jazz rock group founded in New York in 67. And really, it was Al Kooper, who was the vagina through which this band was born. His career could make a series of episodes in itself, but we're kind of not here to talk about him because that first album really kind of has nothing to do with what the group became.
It has nothing to do with everything to do because this was the genesis of the project. And in many ways, things didn't change because they always had four horn players. They always had, you know, Steve Katz playing guitar and Bobby Colomby's incredible drums and Jim Fielder's amazing bass. But the thing that changed, though, was the fact that this album has an underdog singer. You know, the thing about Al is that he's got that quirky voice and kind of a Bob Dylan kind of way. And I think what's rubbing you wrong is that they brought in like this big husky singer with a capital S who also had bad tendencies of being like a little too Vegas sometimes.
Not sometimes. This dude is the most overbearing pile of shit vocalist that I mean, the big hits, the ones that they're known for, Spinning Wheel, I detest.
Well, he wrote that song all by himself, and he's a genius for that. And, you know, the thing about Clayton Thomas, and I'm going to defend him as much as I can, because, look, I've heard a lot of horror stories of him as a person. Personally, he's been very nice to me, but as a musician, I would kill to have a voice like that. I mean, it's amazing. He still sings great, and he's got a beautiful sound. And
by the way, before they pulled him on board, Bobby Colomby and Katz, they had considered Alex Chilton, Stephen Stills, and Laura Nero before.
Yeah, it was a management decision because Laura was in, and that would have been really cool. I actually was part of a project back in the 2000s called Hillary McRae. She was the first new artist signed to Starbucks Hear Music, And it was funny, in 2007, the order of releases was Paul McCartney, James Taylor live album, Joni Mitchell's ballet album, and then Hillary McRae, and after that was supposed to be Carly Simon. And the Hillary project was a horn project. She was super influenced by like Michael McDonald, and she was going to Berkeley. But I had this idea of putting horns around her and saying, maybe this is what Blood, Sweat, and Tears with Laura Nero would have sounded like. And it came out really cool. Unfortunately, it didn't go anywhere. I still hear the single at Walgreens every once in a while. But I would have killed to have Laura at least do one record with them.
Talk about going the opposite direction. I mean, the interesting thing, I gotta hand it to them. It's interesting, yet it's also mind-blowingly deadening to me, is that it's less a band and more of a brand because it's a vehicle. There's been over 165 members of Blood, Sweat, and Tears so far. So it's really more of an idea than it is a band. It's a concept. And, you know, the thing that I find both interesting and that kills it right out of the gate for me is a band like Jefferson Airplane. When you look at a band that has countercultural ideals and waves that flag super high, and that becomes the grist of their entire mill, and then very slowly evolves through cocaine music into becoming a sheer corporate product with Mickey Thomas fronting them. To me, Blood, Sweat, and Tears in 1969 is like if Mickey Thomas fronted Jefferson Airplane.
Disagree.
I know, we disagree, but here's why. To me, Child is Father to the Man is like a jazz rock Sgt. Pepper. And then within a few months, you have pure Vegas. To me, the self-titled record is all Vegas. And I'm surprised, actually, that it was accepted, even if for a brief moment, before that Eastern European tour kind of killed their perception of being a countercultural band, that if just for a moment they were seen as a countercultural band.
Yes and no. I totally see the Sgt. Pepper aspect of Child is Father to the Man. But there is a concept also with BST2, with the opening and ending with the Erik Satie theme, and the fact that they were able to go through so many different genres. And also, I feel like that album is sequenced like a concert. It's one of the best sequenced albums of all time to me. I could take that album in one sip. It is absolutely beautiful the way it's paced. There's not a bad song on it.
To me, there's only two good songs on it. The Satie thing I like, but let me just say, throwing a piano etude at the top and having a reprise at the end does not a concept album make. That's a lazy man's concept album.
I know, it's not.
And fair enough, it is a band in search of their identity because they had to kind of rearrange from the ground up. But to me, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, which is Blood, Sweat, and Tears 2, is not as egregiously harmful to my ears as 3, which I hate. I hate Blood, Sweat, and Tears 3.
Mm-hmm.
Lucretia McEvil is one of my least favorite songs I have ever heard in my entire life. The only song I like on that record, and it's only because Manuel's original version is so touching, you can't ruin it.
Lonesome Susie.
But for the only time I've ever heard Clayton Thomas, who, by the way, the members of the association used to call David Clayton asshole. And I know he's your friend, and you're standing up for him. That's why you're the perfect guest for this episode. Lonesome Susie, I don't know why he couldn't have put a little bit more tenderness behind material like Fire and Rain. He attacks almost everything he touches like a sledgehammer into a glass window.
Oh, shut!
And now, an important message from Don Bowles.
Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for District Attorney of Los Angeles who has over a decade of experience successfully defending those falsely accused of crimes. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate running for Los Angeles District Attorney who is dedicated to ending mass incarceration. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who co-created and produced the televised freakout public access show known as The Three Geniuses, which the LA Weekly dubbed the most intentionally psychedelic show on television. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who is an accomplished phototheremist. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who now has a record label with punk rock legend and all-around weirdo Don Bowles. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate running for Los Angeles District Attorney who was not only the features editor at Hustler Magazine, but also Larry Flint's editorial point man for his First Amendment lawsuit against the military-industrial complex and the Pentagon. If you believe in liberty, justice, and the American way, vote for Dan Kapelowitz. Stick it to the man. Vote for Dan. Dan Kapelowitz.
I'm Dan Kapelowitz, and I approve this message.
Well, the vocal on For My Lady on 4 is possibly my favorite lead vocal of all time. So we're going to have fun.
No, hold on. I think 4 is their second best album.
I agree. To me, it's my favorite album of theirs. That's an album that I will go to my grave with. I literally want to be buried with that record.
I want to hate that record, but I don't. The material on it, you have Cowboys and Indians, which is a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. Lyrics written by Terry Kirkman. Yeah. And by the way, he implored me to include that in the episode, the association interview. It's a masterpiece. John the Baptist, which is a solid Al Kooper tune. For My Lady, I agree with you.
That song, by the way, really fucked up things between Cats, the label, and I have a lot of inside information you guys are going to learn, because that song was the final straw for Cats, because he wrote that about his wife, and the label insisted on Clayton Thomas singing it, and he said his skin crawled hearing, you know, Clayton Thomas being such a womanizer singing these tender lyrics about his wife. But I'll tell you, man, I had a magical moment once with a girlfriend where I played her that song and she was completely in tears. It's one of the most beautiful songs ever made. As much as I love Cats, he can never emote the way that Clayton Thomas did.
It's interesting that you say that. My honest opinion is that the moments for me, once Clayton Thomas comes into the band, that are salvageable are...
Salvageable, Jesus.
I'm serious. Yeah, I'm serious. Is Sometimes in Winter is the only song that I like on Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
That song gives me intense chills. And I love the flute. I love the bass line. I love everything about it. Steve Katz, you know, he's the most underrated songwriter in the band. His stuff is incredible. Valentine's Day just kills me. For My Lady.
Let's talk about the progression of the band. For people who don't know, and I want you to know how seriously I took this, I listened to every single record a couple times over, took fastidious notes, and then woke up at 2 a.m. today and listened to absolutely everything all over again, except for Nuclear City, because no fucking way. So
I love that record.
Oh my God.
That record. Nuclear
like
Blues.
Like I said, apologist.
You know what? It's not the greatest because of the disco element, but I will take that version of Manic Depression over any Hendrix version.
Oh my God.
I love it.
Are you kidding me?
And I play it, dude, I've played that version for so many musicians and they lose their shit, man.
Yeah, they shit their pants.
They love it. It's absolutely incredible.
So the
Bobby fucking Economou.
So you know, here's the progression. Is we have Al Kooper for a very brief time, who
practically killed himself trying to set this thing up. And then when he did, you know, he writes a very prophetic song in the first record, My Days Are Numbered, yeah. which is hysterically funny, all things considered. And then they get in David Clayton Thomas. That is the era of the band that almost everyone on the planet knows. Then he leaves. Jerry Fisher comes in. He's the vocalist for a small handful of records.
Three.
Then Clayton Thomas comes back in, and they become a less varied band. Would you say that?
You know, the upstate New York era, that's what basically happened. Columbia opened up a studio in upstate. That era, it started becoming a show band, which is a terrible word in rock and roll. But there's still incredible moments on all four of those records that he did post-Fisher.
I'd have to respectfully disagree with you on that one. I mean, the Fisher stuff is interesting to me because it sounds like, it feels anyway, like a band that has been under a reign of terror of somebody that has taken over the band, and they're kind of loosening their belts and just having fun with different styles instead of feeling, it doesn't feel like they feel obligated to do this, that, and the other thing, but they're just, you know, stretching out whether or not you like the music. When Clayton Thomas comes back in the band, to me, it's stultifying. I mean, the ballads have become extremely syrupy, extremely schmaltzy. They're not moving to me anymore. You know, the moments that were moving, like Sometimes in Winter, Velvet, those kinds of songs, you know, and we're in like pure schmaltz territory. You got to admit. Right? I mean, those ballads are kind of reaching for Manilow type effect.
No, I was a witness to a Wark playing in my head right now, and I'm losing my mind.
I'm losing my mind too. I just heard it about an hour ago.
No, it's such a beautiful song.
I wanted to gouge my fucking brain out with
it. It's such a beautiful song. Blue Street? Blue Street is incredible.
Blue Street is the only decent song on that record, and that's not because of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. That's because of Randy Edelman.
Yeah, and Randy Edelman's amazing. I've actually worked with him.
I know Randy very well. Randy's my dad great. Went to high school with him, and he was actually going to score one of my films. That's He's cool. also got great taste in women, too.
That's funny.
He does.
That's right.
What's your least favorite Blood, Sweat, and Tears album?
Brand New Day. It does have issues. I would say the biggest issue of Brand New Day is, sadly, Danny Triffin. He's the bass player on that record. You know, Fielder was a really big pair of shoes to fill. You know, Ron McClure did a great job. But I feel like Danny Triffin, you know, the problem is they had Jacko for a second. And it feels
I know. Every
bass, here's the issue, because I had this discussion with Bobby Colomby. Every bass player that they've had since Jacko has been a Jacko clone. And the sound of Blood, Sweat, and Tears is flat wound strings, high action, and heavy handed playing. And the problem with Jacko, and I've never been able to get into him. My favorite fretless bass player is John Giblin. My second favorite fretless bass player is Rick Danko. I like throaty bass. Mm-hmm. And the problem with Jacko is that he's barely hitting strings. He's not aggressive at all. And Danny Triffin, you know, I just feel like his voice is not up to spec.
By the way, I agree with you. Brand New Day is their worst album.
The bass player on Nuclear Blues is David Pilch, who's a legend out here in L.A. He's actually a first call upright bass player. And even though he's doing the fretless thing, he's attacking the strings, and it sounds great. I would actually hold Nuclear Blues, when I do my final rating, I actually put that in number 6. You know, I actually like that record more than Brand New Day. I like that record more than New City. New City is another one that falls flat with me.
I agree. It's a step up from that and More Than Ever. It's a step up from that and Mirror Image.
Well, More Than Ever's got a really cool vibe because of the whole Bob James thing. I hate the album cover. I'd love to know the story behind.
The album cover is terrible.
I'd love to know the story behind that half-assed shit. Because I'll tell you, I could be very opinionated, and I get very opinionated about the way people market themselves. And Blood, Sweat, and Tears has had some great album covers, man.
I don't like New City, if that's where you're going to go with this.
No. New City doesn't do anything for me. I'm talking about those eyes.
I don't like the eyes.
Well, no, actually, you're talking about Mirror Image.
Mirror Image, that's right. I don't like
Mirror,
that album.
You know what? I do love the eyes, because you know what? It's such a cool concept, and then the full photo here. But it's like, man, these guys, you know, it's a way to make a very ugly looking set of dudes, because, you know, jazz musicians, they don't even brush their teeth, you know.
It's very unwelcoming looking.
Acid, speed, and rampant infidelity. And that's before the band recorded a single note. Fleetwood Mac's got nothing on the Mamas and the Papas. I don't care if you love them or not, if they're in your wheelhouse or far, far outside of it, the Michelle Phillips Interview of a Lifetime series coming March 22nd on Discograffiti is absolutely riveting. I promise you, you've never heard anything quite like it. Michelle, you want to take them out?
It's hard to be really candid about so many disturbing things. And you've made me feel that I can do that. And I am very grateful to you for giving me that opportunity to talk without feeling like I'm afraid of what I'm saying.
Save the date, March 22nd. Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime. You won't know what hit you.
Let's talk about More Than Ever for a second, because even though the band at that point has 10 members, there's over 10 session players that join them.
Yeah.
Why does the soup have to be so thick with ingredients? To me, that just creates...
Bob James.
It's too much. It's too much.
But Bob James had his own vision of it. And, you know, it's the same thing that happens when Foster took over Chicago. You know, because look, let's face it. Dude, Lukather's playing half the guitars on those Chicago records in the 80s. And they brought in Porcaro. They brought in all the Porcaros. And, you know, when it comes down to it, that was also a band that was still kind of getting back into the Clayton Thomas world. But, you know, they still had incredible players. I mean, dude, Tony Klotka, freaking Larry Willis. Still amazing guys, but Bob James is a great piano player on his own, so...
Yeah, I'm not saying that. I mean, Hugh McCracken's on it, Eric Weisberg. There's good players on it, but what I'm saying is, why the fuck do you need over 20 people on a record? To me, that's just cocaine talking, those kinds of decisions. It makes the music as bland and nondescript as the cover.
You look, there's a reason why Blood, Sweat, and Tears fell out of favor. Let's just face it, you know, their golden age, to me, was through Fisher. The return of Clayton Thomas, I don't think it was a musical decision. I think it was a decision by the label saying, we need, you know, it happens all the time. There's been many times in the history of rock and roll where a replacement singer has done great. But the minute that the original guy gets back up there, the crowd goes crazy because they want their comfort food, you know?
Yeah.
And when people think of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, let's just face it. Musicians think of Al Kooper. Their general crowd think of it. When I Die, Spinning Wheel, You Made Me So Very Happy, Lucretia McEvil, Heidi Ho.
You know. Let's come together on a couple of interesting points about the band. I don't believe that in their heart, through 99% of their existence, even though it was set up by a card-carrying, dyed-in-the-wool countercultural guru, Al Kooper was at the forefront of so many movements, I don't believe they are a countercultural band at heart. I think they were trying to bring big band into rock music, which is, I have no problem with that as a concept, but I think that them starting out as a countercultural notion, it just is a strange blend, because having them at Woodstock, you know, certainly that Eastern European tour, which I honestly didn't even know was a thing until that film came out, you know, that shouldn't have been an issue, because to me, these are not rebels.
This is bringing up a good point, because the band, this is one of the things that's explained in the movie, is that the band had its camps. You know, there was the rock musician guys, like Katz, you know, in many ways, Clayton Thomas. And then there's the jazz guys. And look, you know, the teacher that showed me Blood, Sweat, and Tears, I did a rock ensemble in classical guitar with Doug Burris at Miami Beach Senior High School. And immediately I got a scholarship to go to Miami-Dade Community College. I decided to take some jazz classes. And you won't find more Nazi-type people than jazz, because it becomes a thing where it's like, don't move around, you know, learn people's solos note for note, lose your identity, you know. And the thing about jazz musicians is, well, actually, a good point about Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Every time I've seen Blood, Sweat, and Tears, there's music stands on stage. Because basically Clayton Thomas would hire a bunch of college kids. And these people have no sense of style. They're not performers. And they're sitting there reading music, and it's not very rock and roll. And the current iteration of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, there's incredible musicians, Rick Fibonacci, they're incredible, but they're not rock and roll. And the thing about Blood, Sweat, and Tears is that they were rock and roll. Jim Fielder was in freaking Buffalo Springfield, you know. Jim Fielder, he's a rock bassist. You know, he had some jazz chops, but he was a rock bassist. And Bobby Colomby, even though he came from a folk jazz world. His brother managed Dizzy Gillespie. He grew up hanging around jazz musicians. He had a rock ethic. And man, he swang and also hit the drums with authority. I think the only other drummer that I can vouch for in Blood, Sweat, and Tears was Bobby Economou, who played on Nuclear Blues. And he's also the drummer on Jocko's record. That guy was a freaking badass.
It's That's amazing another... to me that you don't like Jocko. It's incredible.
Well, no, it's not that I don't like Jocko. I respect Jocko, and I've learned a lot from Jocko as a bass player.
What about his work on Hajira? I mean, that is
It's great. Astounding. It's great. It's beautiful. But here's the thing about Jocko.
For anyone that doesn't know, Jocko toured with the band, but before they recorded, I can't remember what year it was, around 74, right?
74, 75.
So before they actually got back to the studio, he was gone.
There's some recordings that Colin Beats promised to get me someday. And I got to tell you, the thing about Jocko, I like aggressive bass. And even though he was an aggressive notes player, I feel like the bass, when you get so thin and so lyrical and so like kind of plinky, it loses its bottom. And I like fat bass. And the thing about Jim Fielder, man, there was more bass on Blood, Sweat, and Tears records than any Chicago record. As much as I love Peter Cetera, it's a different vibe. He's playing with a pick. He's being kind of like plunky. The thing about Jim Fielder, it's like Jamerson. He's like Jamerson meets Ron Carter.
What's your stance on Electric Flag?
Buddy of fucking Miles. You know, man, I mean, that's one of my favorite drummers of all time.
That first record is amazing. That first record could be the best of all the jazz rock groups at that time.
The songwriting wasn't there, and it's too much blues. That's my opinion.
And not enough heroin. And then Chicago, to me, you know, they peter out. They're really good, except way too voluminous of a batch of material. They needed somebody saying, you don't need all this stuff on the records.
I'm going to lose all my credibility in music right now. My favorite Chicago album is Hot Streets.
Oh, Mike, I knew you were going to fucking say that.
But you're right.
There goes your credibility.
But no, there's a very specific reason why Hot Streets is my favorite record. It's because it's got no skips. And the issue with my second favorite Chicago record, which is Chicago Transit Authority, I don't like freeform guitar.
I hear you.
If it wasn't for freeform guitar, that would be one of the greatest albums of all time.
The funniest thing about Hot Streets is that they go numerical, 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 and 10 years into their career, they decide to change it for the worst titled album of all time. I don't understand. Then they go back to the numbers. As far as I'm concerned, you know, Chicago, once they lost Terry, it was kind of all over.
I know, but man, Downey Dacus was an incredible player, but he had a suicide mission. It was a suicide mission to replace Terry. You know, they should have done a record with no guitar and, you know, said, all right, you know, retire the position. You know, bring in a second keyboardist to do keyboard leads, because it was really impossible. But man, for my money, my favorite song from Chicago is a song called Take a Chance that's on that record. And when I met Chicago, I went backstage at a show at the Forum. I went straight to Lee Loughlin and said, my favorite Chicago song, you wrote it. He says, which one? I'm like, Take a Chance. He says, really?
You know, you just convinced me that you were a man very comfortable in your own skin. Because
I am.
It takes balls to say that. And I respect, really a lot of respect, that you would say Hot Streets is your favorite Chicago album. That takes balls.
You know what my second favorite Chicago song is?
Oh, baby, What a Big Surprise.
Hell fuck no.
What?
It's a B-side on Chicago 13 called Closer to You, written by Stephen Stills and Donnie Dacus. Put that
Not familiar with it.
Put that shit on, and you are just cruising on the sea of frickin' beauty. That's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. It's Latin, it's funky, and it's sexy. And it's so good. There's another version of the song on Illegal Stills. Remember Illegal Stills?
Yeah, I do.
It's a cool record. And man, you know, fucking Stephen Stills. You know, that's another example. You know, he has a reputation. Don't call him Steve. You know, he's very odd. And I had a bizarre interaction with him.
I had a good interaction with him, actually.
Oh, good. Good to hear. I wanted to tell him about Closer to You, but he didn't really want to talk to me, so it's all good. But I still love him.
Yeah, I used to wait tables at Musso and Frank's. And he was there with his wife. And I said, you know what? It's not too late to release Johnny's Garden as a single. You got it. That was a missed opportunity. His wife turned to him and said, see, I told you.
Johnny's Garden. Song. Well, Manassas, you see that band and you're like, oh, this must be a horn band. It's such a big band. But man, they got such a big sound without the horns. But I consider Manassas kind of a good example of what Blood, Sweat, and Tears would have sounded like with Stephen Stills on vocals. Because, man, right. If he would have brought Johnny's Garden in with those horns, you know, it doesn't matter. Freaking Black Queen.
Yeah. He could have brought in a Cuban element, too, that really is kind of missing from...
Well, when Don Alias joined Blood, Sweat, and Tears, he brought in that percussion element. That's what actually made Colomby decide to just, like, stop playing drums, because one day he says they switched, and he's like, they don't need me, you know? I'm just going to go run the business. You know, when Bobby became a suit, the world lost one of its best drummers, and he's definitely one of my top 20 drummers of all time.
So let's talk about the Jerry Fisher era, because really, this is the era that people don't know about. And by the way, in doing the research on this, it's so interesting to me, because he had a house for a long time. Very lucky guy. He sold it a few months right before a hurricane. It was actually
a club. He had a restaurant and a club.
That's what it was.
And a nightclub. I had a similar situation with my old studio. There was a fire on this first floor right after I moved out. Yeah, his entire club washed away.
And he had it for a long time. If he doesn't wake up grateful every day, I don't know what to tell him. Well, because he's in Colorado now, apparently. He's living the life, and he's alive.
You know what, man? What an incredible singer. What an incredible-looking dude. I don't know if you've seen any of the footage from Germany in 75 on the Mirror Image Tour.
Hi, I'm Dave Gebro. I threw my career as a licensed hearing instrument specialist in the trash, sold my house, and moved to the East Coast with my wife and four-year-old son in order to focus on making the ultimate podcast for music obsessives thrive. Now I need your help. Although Discograffiti is rated in the top 2% of all podcasts globally, the economics of this thing are tricky. Becoming a member of Discograffiti's Patreon gives you access to over 100 more exclusive episodes. And moving forward now, every Sunday, for only $5 a month as a private first class, you get our new weekly show by and for Discograffiti's Patreon family, the Discograffiti Soldiers of Sound podcast. It'll be hosted by Rudy Fishman, and given his sociopathic tendencies, I'm sure it'll have a lunatic's takeover the asylum edge to it. If all you want to do is show some love, there's now finally a $1 tier. Don't miss out. Become a recruit and get your personalized backstage pass for $1. And for the cheapskates, homeless people, and all the bums sponging off mom and dad, don't care, just join. It's now completely free to join as a basic member, and it'll be the only place you'll be able to get our upcoming Lou Barlow, Corey Hansen, Mark Robinson comp, Metal Machine Muzak, as well as the triple album rock opera Elf Harmony I created with Joe Kennedy as the Mentally Regarded, and the ability to purchase one-off Patreon episodes. That's it. Back to the show. For anyone that is not familiar with Jerry Fisher, here's my take on this era. I think that it was an overcompensated course correction.
That's funny.
What I think is Blood, Sweat, and Tears went from an overly distinctive, and in my opinion, obviously shitty vocalist, to a completely understandable, given the circumstances, place filler vocalist with no defining characteristic touch to bring to the music, except that he doesn't have laryngitis.
Ooh. Ow.
I'm just looking at it from the musician's point of view.
Ow.
Here's a guy that's stepping all over their charts. Mm. Okay. The concert going public, a lot of them are coming for David Clayton Thomas. And so these guys, understandably, want to share in the spotlight, and who the hell can blame them? They've been trammeled by David Clayton Thomas. So they get a guy who is a workmanlike singer.
Yeah.
And as I say that, you know, I don't think Jerry Fisher's a bad singer. I just don't think he has towering personality. And I think that that's what they were looking for. So when I look at New Blood, No Sweat, and Mirror Image, those are the three, right?
Mm-hmm. No Sweat, man. Wow. That record rules.
I don't know about that. New Blood's my favorite. I would give that 2.5 out of 5. No Sweat, I give 2 stars. Mirror Image, I give 1. That gets progressively worse. But to me, it's a band just kind of stretching out, having some fun. Look, I don't seethingly hate it. I just find it boring, which is at least better, I guess, than seething hatred. Although, frankly, as a music obsessive, I want to be moved one way or the other violently.
Gotcha.
So the middle of the road is of sort of less interest to me. I'd rather hate the music than feel like it's serviceable.
Okay. Jerry Fisher was what Blood, Sweat, and Tears would have sounded like with Ray Charles on vocals.
Wow.
Beautiful soul man. His voice is molasses to me. And he still had the ability to be that honking Clayton Thomas thing. But man, you got to hear him sing, "I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know." So beautiful.
Have you met him?
I haven't met him and I haven't talked to him. But, you know, I'd love to, because definitely in my top five favorite Blood, Sweat, and Tears songs is a song called Alone, which was written by Blue Lou Marini.
It's almost got like a heavy metal-esque edge to it.
Well, there's a little bit of a Chicago vibe, definitely on certain parts, but that song just grooves. And one of the secret weapons of the band. Let's talk about horns for a second. Motown. They're kind of like, just kind of like a rhythmic instrument. Stabs, boom, bah. Jazz, it's just, you know, every note that you could possibly play to the point where you can't sing any of the lines. The thing about Blood, Sweat, and Tears versus Chicago, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Tower of Power, 10-Wheel Drive, all the other horn bands, the thing about Blood, Sweat, and Tears is that they were able to mix soul horns, jazz horns, Latin horns with that Maynard Ferguson thing. Because actually, I read the original influence that Al Kooper had was seeing Maynard Ferguson.
Right.
And there's that Latin thing. There's that Willie Bobo. There's so many different influences. Because, man, you know, I'm Cuban. And I remember Bobby Colomby apologizing for the Latin part of God Bless the Child. And I'm like, man, I approve. That sounds to me like the Benny Moré Orchestra of Cuba.
Are you a Blues Project fan?
You know, Flute Fing, sure.
Live at the Cafe of Go-Go, have you
it's
heard
great,
that?
It's great, but blues is kind of a... Ugh.
I think it's just in the name.
I know. But it, you know what? They were fantastic. And man, that performance in Monterey kills me.
Yeah, you're talking about the flute thing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I think that's the only thing I've seen is them doing flute.
It's them flute thing, which is amazing. You know, look, they're great, and there's a lot of the proto Steve Katz, you know, Al Kooper thing. But really, that was Danny Kalb's band, and I'm not super crazy about Danny. It's just not my thing.
I love him. I love him, man.
He's great, you know. But again, it's a different vibe. But going back to the horns, man. You know, when you compare side by side, Lee Loughlin versus Lou Soloff, you know, Walt Perezader versus Fred Lipsis, you know, and there's a big one, Dave Bargeron. What I found out is that they had issues with their original trombone player. When they brought in Bargeron, he became such a powerful voice on the trombone and the tuba. And there's that tuba solo in Go Down Gambling. And that trombone solo on Alone, man, that blows my mind. And, you know, I think the best soloist in Chicago is their trombone player. You know, he's amazing. But Bargeron, that guy, he's just a big dude, and he's, there's a lot of air going through those horns. And it's just such an amazing sound.
A lot of hot air. Here's my take on everything at once, on the idea of having, for example, 10 guys in a band and then 13 session players on top of it.
Yeah.
I believe that it's pasta on the walls maximalism as a substitute for creativity. I believe they thought, you know, maybe it's the mid-70s, you know, cocaine-induced attitude and, you know, everything kind of dovetailing in a creative way in that respect. It's possible that that was the thing, but I feel like they thought if you saturate the tape enough, you kind of wouldn't notice that there's anything missing.
I can't think of a band that something missing is least applicable to. Because one of the things that I love about Blood, Sweat, and Tears, it's overloaded, you know? There's so many sounds
coming at you.
That's
what I mean, is that just because the tape is totally saturated doesn't mean that it's balls to the wall creativity.
Oh, hi, Dave again. I got to tell you about the next tier. As a lieutenant, you get an ad-free, substantially elongated director's cut of every episode. And you'll be getting the shows an entire week early from now on. And now back to our expertly crafted program.
You know, just like most of the jazz cats can agree, it's what you don't play. I almost never hear them leaving a note out. Blood, Sweat, and Tears are not known for leaving notes out.
Yeah, but you know what? Yes and no. Because Cowboys and Indians has so much beautiful space in it.
Cowboys and Indians is a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that's an outlier. Lonesome Susie, again, but like Fire and Rain, which was an example that you brought up, you know, he attacks that song. I don't know why he attacks it.
You
know,
I mean, that song for a group of songwriters that we were just having a music hang, and they were like completely jaw-dropped. When I hear the original version of James Taylor, it's beautiful.
James Taylor is a bit of a guilty pleasure for me, only up till about 75. I'm almost embarrassed to say that, you know, look, as a 52-year-old man,
yeah.
I'm not embarrassed to say I like anything. I mean, you know, I love the Genesis song, Throwing It All Away.
I love that.
Is one of the most moving songs I've ever heard. I don't care that it's on Invisible Touch. I really don't.
That's the best song on that record.
It is the best song on that record.
Yeah.
But, you know, to me, Fire and Rain, their version of it is a mismatch of intent to material. You know, he's looking to wow when, you know, he has it in him, as can be heard on Lonesome Susie, to actually go in a slightly more subtle approach and to be affecting, but he almost never chooses that route.
But I'm going to go musical on that. The way the horns play seconds, it's almost Brian Wilson-like on that song. Seconds as
on Fire and Rain?
On Fire and Rain. There's moments where the trumpets are playing one note away from each other, and it really makes you feel uncomfortable. And it's an uncomfortable lyric. I mean, this woman's killed herself, you know, so it's like having that two-note rub, especially I'm hearing it in my head right now during the last chorus, it makes me cry. It's just so beautiful. And I've never felt anything extreme listening. This is weird. I've never felt anything listening to James Taylor because his voice is kind of the same all the way through. Mm-hmm.
And it's got that adenoidal nasal twang to it. And I understand.
I'd kill to have his voice.
But also, he keeps coming back to the same guitar moves.
Yes.
Even the stuff that I like. And it's the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that thing.
Yes.
It's just like Elton John when he's doing.
Exactly. You know,
That's
why I'm way more of a Billy Joel guy than Elton John, because I feel like Elton repeats himself.
There. Don't go there.
Repeats himself constantly.
Okay, agreed. But
you've never cried listening to Souvenir? Come on, dude. I've missed Souvenir? These days. I've loved these days. Come on. Chills.
Listen, chills. I'm telling you, don't go chills. To the Billy Joel thing.
Chills.
Don't do the Billy Joel.
Chills.
You don't want to send me there. Trust
chills.
Me.
Chills.
You don't want to send me to the Billy Joel place.
The last 10 seconds of She's Got Away. Ah.
The only song that I can say really, really moves me that Billy Joel has done, and it's just not fair because, you know, I despise the guy so fucking much. Just the Way You Are is a perfect song.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
I've had wonderful
it's
moments
like,
with that song.
I can't hear that song without at least being on the verge of tears. And I hate him for it because I think he's the Antichrist. But let's not go there.
Well,
I respect.
Wait till you
that
hear,
would
wait,
not be fair.
Wait till you hear the Billy Joel David Clayton Thomas album I'm making for you.
I'm going to punch you in the nuts and the taint.
Ladies and gentlemen, Clayton Thomas sings Joel. Joel sings Clayton Thomas.
There was an independent record label in the 80s that released Billy Joel's greatest hits, and it was blank vinyl.
Oh, fuck that. Come on, dude. So much hate.
No, you know, I mean, this is the foundation stone. Look, I started this podcast, and I kind of was a little bit of an asshole at first.
Hey, it's all good.
So Joe and I, and we've never released this, our very first episode we ever did was Beck. And I listened back to it with my wife, Jen, and we both agreed that I was coming off as angry for some reason, for whatever reason. Don't know why. I don't remember the circumstances of that particular day of recording. And we redid the Beck episode. And from the second time we recorded, which was Pink Floyd, from there forward, I left that behind because, you know, if you go to the Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound, everything is allowed in there. Even if you're going to push Billy Joel, that's fine with me. As long as you feel strongly about it, I don't care. That's fine. You know, everything is inclusive. Nothing is disallowed. But what makes us able to do this and not feel affronted or pained in our chest, or why doesn't he like me, is that you are me and I am you. Except Hot Streets is a pile of dung, but we feel strongly about these things.
Well, you know, if music doesn't make you want to dance, fuck, beat up something, you know, freaking go crazy, you know, hug someone. That's the beautiful thing about music, is that it has an amazing effect on our brains. And, you know, it's perfectly fine to have something get you angry. I get angry every time I hear a drum machine. That's just my own personal vendetta against programming and auto-tune and, you know, all the whatever the hell's being passed along as music. And man, this is very fresh, but I hate sampling. You know, I hate the fact that people are stealing other people's art to create collage art that they're passing along as the fucking Mona Lisa. No, man, that's grandma's scrapbook.
Well, let's talk about like De La Soul Is Dead or 3 Feet High and Rising. Those records wouldn't exist if it wasn't for sampling.
Best rap record I ever heard was Jurassic 5, and there's no sampling there. It's real live music. You know, it's really, really good stuff. And, you know, the thing about it is they were getting off on a tangent, but my personal opinion is make your own art. Get influenced, but don't steal.
The main thing is that I respect you, even though you are fighting for the integrity of a group that was fronted for 5 years by a runner-up from American Idol.
No, I disagree. Bo Bice.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears for 5 years was fronted by Bo Bice, an American Idol runner-up. And then in 2019, Keith Peluso from The Voice was chosen as their new singer.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, there's your counterculture for you. Anyone who's ever waving a flag for any ideals whatsoever always ends up in the same fucking place.
Can't defend what Blood, Sweat, and Tears has turned into. Colby can, because you know what? It's very funny. If you go to bloodsweatandtears.com, you know, they ask him, it's like, hey, how come there's no original or classic members? And he says, well, people still go see the Yankees and Babe Ruth is in there. You know, people go to the London Philharmonic and there's no original members.
Look at Kraftwerk. Isn't that the whole idea is just to send holograms and robots?
There's no original members in Gong, but David Allen said Gong is not a band. Gong is a species.
Right. Well, so is Blood, Sweat, and Tears. I mean, it's over 165 people who've been associated with this thing. And, you know, when Clayton Thomas, after Nuclear Blues, just gave up the ghost and tried to start a solo career, he kind of had to give up because there were complications during touring because promoters would just book his group and use the Blood, Sweat, and Tears name on the marquee. So his manager, Larry Doerr, negotiated a licensing deal with Columbia in 84 for rights to tour with that name. They're a brand. It's not a rock band. It's a rock brand.
It's a rock brand. But, you know, the thing about it also, it happens all the time. You know, when the Station nightclub fire happened, technically, it was Jack Russell's Great White. It was not Great White, you know? So that's the thing. It happens all the time where singers just cannot tour without having that band name. And the minute that band name gets brought back in, the ticket sales double because people want to see Blood, Sweat, and Tears. They don't want to see David Clayton Thomas. The thing about it is, like, yeah, when I saw Blood, Sweat, and Tears, it was David Clayton Thomas and a bunch of other guys. I mean, great players. But, you know, it really was the David Clayton Thomas show, which it's unfair. You know, I see it all the time where the lead singer is the one carrying the band.
I have to tell you, and this is a philosophy that I have. The fact that this group and other groups like it, that I just don't understand the success behind it, the fact that they are successful is exactly why for many years when I go to restaurants and the server comes over, I don't ask, you know, what do people like? I ask, what do you get?
Exactly.
Not what do people order. If you're going to, you know, look for what everyone ordered, you're going to wind up with a special, which is whatever's about to go to pot rotting out in the back.
Exactly.
By the chef.
You know, one thing I want to bring up, I've worked with Yes Official for the last 10 years. I'm really good friends with Martin Darville, who's the manager of Yes. That's a perfect example of a situation where Yes Official is Steve Howe, Jeff Downs, and the guys that Chris Squire personally picked to replace him and, you know, be in the band, Jay Shellen, who was a personal replacement for Alan White, and Billy Sherwood, who was a personal replacement for Chris Squire.
That's different, though. Let me
every time they're like, where's John? Where's John? Where's John? No John, no Yes. Man.
Yeah, but you know, here's the difference. Here's the difference. For me, anyway. They were a valid creative concern until the early 80s, in my personal opinion. Also, with the record Drama, they became a completely different band that was just as good.
It was
actually
amazing.
Better.
Yeah, I love
Drama's
it. I love
better
Drama.
Than Tormato. Much better than
I'd Tormato. I'd say I listened to Drama more than Close to the Edge.
All right, I wouldn't go that far, but I prefer
the live versions of the three songs on Close to the Edge with Alan White. Just my personal opinion. But Drama is an amazing record, and Trevor Horn and Jeff Downs rule.
So they are creating a precedent where they're just as acceptable and valid a creative concern with or without John Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's great. To me, without John, you're missing a lot. But drama and what would have been cinema,
yeah,
but became, yes, they were great up until, you know, Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, and How They Lost Me There, and Big Generator. I don't care about that stuff.
Big Generator sucks.
Yeah, but, you know, they were great for quite a long time.
Yeah, and they're still great.
So when you become a major, you get yet another show on Wednesday. Either Discography's The Top 10, our buried treasure show, Rock Cousteau, our slag-off show, Queasy Listening, or exclusive limited series like The Private Press with Paul Major. And if you've got no financial worries to speak of, keep in mind that some of the higher Patreon tiers allow you to actually advertise on the show, choose the bands we cover, or even some of the guests we get. For the price of a cup of coffee a week, you can ensure my family's fed, build a music library that'll be the envy of your block, and connect to a thriving community of music maniacs all at the same time. Don't risk feeling badly about yourself by not giving. Patreon.com/discography. Once again, that's patreon.com/discography.
To me, yeah, David Clayton Thomas was like a super aggressive main person of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, but I respect every member the same way. And I feel like the Jerry Fisher era was just as good. I wish they had more singers. I wish they would have said, David, you quit the band.
I wish they had different singers.
Yeah, well, you this is important. Singers. When Fisher left, when they had Jerry LaCroix, I wish they would have made more records with Jerry LaCroix. I wish they would have found somebody else. You know who would have been great? Jay Gruska. They thought about Jay Gruska for a while. And there was a point where they were going to bring in Bobby Doyle. And Bobby Doyle was too much of a drunk.
I think they should have brought in Kelly Clarkson and Justin Guarini.
Fuck that, man. Come on, dude.
I want to talk about you for a little while before we wind down. So yeah. Ultimately, the audience is going to decide. We're at the end. The bell has rung. We're going back to our corners. It's Rocky Balboa and Apollo Creed. It's up to you to decide now who's won this battle. Go to the Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. Tell us who you think won this battle. Comment under the promo. And also, crucially, if you repost this on, where are you? You're on Facebook, yeah. Instagram, and Twitter. All right. So if you repost and tag Fernando and myself, you are in the running for a raffle for 5 of Fernando's picks.
Yeah.
He's contributed and helped to produce and done quite a lot in the music industry. We're going to have a raffle for 5 different winners here.
Yeah.
So tag us, repost.
Repost.
And now I want to veer left and I want to talk about your accomplishments because your CV is so crazy. It is so endless. When I went onto your Wikipedia page to look at all the people you'd worked with, all the records you'd helped to make, how did you get into this?
Well, first of all,
how do you work so much?
I'm going to bring Blood, Sweat, and Tears into this conversation. So I'm 10 years old. No, you know what? I might have been 13. I went to go see Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and I met David Clayton Thomas afterwards. And you're not going to believe this. The record he signed that I brought was Brand New Day. And I remember telling him, I want to play guitar for Blood, Sweat, and Tears. What do I do? And he said, well, first you need to grow up. Second, you need to go to jazz school. And I'm like, okay, cool. And it was actually really cool meeting him. But you know what? I've always had high aspirations of myself. And I also could definitely make lemons out of lemonade. And I've always been criticized by other people.
Criticized how?
Oh, no. Because you know what? I was never fast enough. I was always too fat. I didn't look like a musician. I didn't look like a rock star.
You look like a rock star to me.
Well, check this out.
You got that star jacket. You got all kinds of hats.
My old bio used to start, I was the kid in the Abbey Road shirt in elementary school that was laughed at by kids and New Kids in the Block shirts. You know, mm-hmm. I was always like, oh, you listen to daddy's music, blah, blah, blah. And even when I was in rock ensemble, I got pissed on by other kids for being the one that'd be like, I'm excited to play a Blood, Sweat, and Tears song. I'm excited to play a Three Dog Night song while everybody else wanted to play Metallica or No Doubt.
Listen, I get it. When I was 14, I have a recollection of the first month of being in high school. On my notebook cover, I was in big letters writing the Notorious Byrd Brothers. No one had any idea what I was into. I was the only, it was like me and a few of my friends who even understood what the hell that was. You know, and you're having the last laugh.
Yeah, you know what I had in my Walkman when I was 12? Birds Untitled.
See, again, you're like, you're hitting the right groups, but you're listening to the wrong records.
Dude.
You prefer that 16-minute version of...
yes, about 8 Miles High?
Yeah.
Dude, one of the best opening songs on any record is Lover on the Bayou on that record. It just kills
me. That's a cool song.
It just kills me. But, Nashville West, dude, take a whiff on me. Yeah!
That could be their worst song. That's like
Truck
their
Stop
worst
Girl.
Song.
Come on, man.
You know what their best underdog classic
what?
Is? Gunga Din.
Gunga Din's cool. You know,
I love Gunga Din.
It's cool. That's an incredible band. You know, their early stuff is life-changing. But, you know, okay, going back to me, I still have people that say, oh, he's not that good. How come he's so successful? You know what? Yeah, I am not that good. I am not, like, a super technical guitar player. I'm versatile, but I'm not hip to a lot of the modern shit. You know, I'm in my own world. My big thing is I'm a hard worker and I'm a hustler. And I live 3,000 miles away from my family, and I'm going to make the best out of this fucking California experience. And within a year, I was playing...
You have a son, right?
I have a son. He's beautiful. And he's wonderful.
He is beautiful.
And he's great. So here's the deal.
Does he play?
No, he's working on it. You know, I didn't want to push anything on him, but he's getting into singing. So check this out. Within a year of me moving to L.A., I was filling in for J.J. Blair, amazing guitar player, on Tuesday nights whenever he needed a fill-in at Cantor's. And one of those nights, Andy Slater came in and heard me play and said, you got to play on this record, which later became Echo in the Canyon. So, you know, that experience was great. Everything I've achieved has come from hustling and having confidence when it comes to what I do. And I'll tell you, I'm not the best musician, but I have a great set of ears, and I'm constantly listening and constantly trying to figure out how I can make the music that I'm presented sound the best. And as a producer, really, that's the way I go. And it's like, you know, listening to these Blood, Sweat, and Tears records, it's like, sonically, they are so amazing. And BST 2 and 3 and 4, especially, you know, they just fly off that turntable. And there's so much of what I love.
Let's stay on you because you already lost that bet.
No worries.
It's up to the public, actually.
It's all
but
good.
But back here's to the me. Thing. So people always ask me, where the fuck do you find the time to put up 4 shows a week? You're the only guy that I look at in terms of the stuff that you post and all the projects you're coming out with, where I think, even with Cafe Bustelo pumping through your veins, I don't know where you find the time to do all that you do. You're going on prog cruises, right?
Yep.
You're producing tons of records by other people. You're producing a ridiculous and prolific amount of stuff just by yourself. You're in Marshall Crenshaw's touring band. How many bands are you in right now?
Well, I mean, look, you know, that's the thing is I love the variety of what I do, and every project has its own beautiful place for me. Some of them are also kind of inactive, so like Dirty Diamond, we played our first show in 2 years. I work with Sam as a solo project. You know, I love Sam, and I'll do anything he wants me to do because he's so great. 9 Mile Station, you know, we put out a record. We're kind of in the process of working on some other different things. I just did a solo single for Will that has Leland Sklar on it, and Marty Rifkin. We did another track with Steve Ferrone. See, nothing is like weekly rehearsals. Nothing is like weekly shows. You know, I find the time. And if I don't, you know, I say, hey, you know, get a replacement, you know. But really, so far, it's been good. I've been able to continue. You know, Parlophonic's the lead guys in Germany. So I only met him once. You know, we send files to each other. Life on Mars, same thing. Earl Chaos lives in Pennsylvania. So we send files to each other. Broken Sound, we are working on our second record.
Tell me about your relationship with Roger Houdet and Think Like a Key.
Holy shit. That guy, he's still one of my best friends, but we were inseparable in high school, and we would listen to old records together and trade CDs, and he got me into Family. He got me into a lot of psychedelic stuff that's really cool, Donovan, and all these different things, and I got him into a lot of prog stuff. Like, I got him into Flash, and he ended up putting out a Flash compilation. And, you know, he's always been business savvy. He had his own record label before anybody I knew. He had Dippy Records when he was still in high school, and it ended up becoming Think Like a Key. Dude, and I've played on all the ex-Norwegian records, which are brilliant. And he's working with, you know, Wally Waller of Pretty Things and Peter Daltrey of Kaleidoscope and Fairfield Parlor. And he just put out an R. Stevie Moore record.
If people want to get to know about you, if they're, you know, for example, out in Australia, out in the UK, in Sweden, they've never, for whatever reason...
You know, the two best ways to get to know me is my Wikipedia page and my Bandcamp page. I put out a lot of shit. And, you know, the way I look at it, people complain like, oh, you post too much, you release too much. You know what, man? I want to leave a nice discography when I pass away. I don't want to be a one album guy. I don't want to be a situation where it's like tragically small career.
I, for one, applaud your relentlessness.
I am very relentless, you know, and I'm still pinching myself that I'm playing with Marshall. I'm still pinching myself that I played with Yes once, you know. It's amazing. I'm still pinching myself that I've had such a varied career. I just did a premiere for the second movie soundtrack I did for a movie called Black Mass.
Plus, the single that you did with the Free Design.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, fabulous, we're going to do more. Man. We're going to do more. But I still pinch myself that I get daily texts from Denny Seiwell, Carmine Appice, Andy Pratt. I did 4 Andy Pratt records. You know, I still talk to all these people, and they're incredibly human, which is amazing. Because, you know, everybody that I met through Echo in the Canyon, aside from Stills, was super, super nice, super, really cool. And look, Stills was a weird situation. My Stills story is like, he showed up. He didn't want any guitar players on his side, so I sat out on the song. You know, and I never got the jam with Stills, but that's okay. It'll happen one day.
Did you ever see the cover of Stills 2? Do you ever notice what's on there?
What?
You know how he's looking forlornly out the window? Yeah. If you fold out the gatefold,
yeah,
there's a kilo of cocaine
sitting
right next to him on the windowsill. Yeah.
Amazing.
You've worked with everyone. Your Linda Perhacs production.
Those records were incredible. Emmett Rhodes, which was awesome. The playing bass on his last record, which Chris Price produced.
On Rainbow End. Right?
Rainbow Ends. I'm the bass player on Rainbow Ends. And I was there for the beginning of the project when Chris Price said, I think I'm going to produce a record for Emmett. Who should be in the band? And I said, Roger Manning, Jason Faulkner, John Bryan. I started rattling out names. And they all ended up on the record, which was amazing. So cool.
Look, I'm in awe of your achievements. I really am. And, you know, it made it that much more painful to dissemble you piece by piece during this episode. But I did it with a tear in my eye, not a maniacal gleam. You know, and that's a credit to what you bring to the music industry. And the real spirit and thrill of doing Discograffiti is, you know, as somebody who's probably more than halfway across the tightrope of life, you know, it's crucial for me to find my brothers, my brethren in this thing, who are just as insane, who have, you know, increased and bumped up the prioritization of music as time goes on, instead of people just abandoning that stuff, letting it go, when clearly it's the most important thing in the universe. Thank you, Fernando.
Thanks, David. That was really fun.
You guys decide, genre-bridging badasses or countercultural backwash. Let us know. Go on the Facebook group and you write down genre-bridging badasses or countercultural backwash. Fernando, I love you.
Love you too, buddy. Core. That was great.
All right, that about does it. Stay tuned because this Friday, March 8th, brings a revamped redux of the most popular episode in Discograffiti history, the rise and fall of Jim Gordon's super episode, with a brand new foreword by Gordon biographer Joel Selvin, whose book on Jim has just been published. A heartfelt Discograffiti thanks goes out to my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, the truly great Fernando Perdomo, Rudy Fishman, Becky Boyd, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the Soldiers of Sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discograffiti Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, and access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discograffiti Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, no sweat. Just email me at info@discograffiti.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper into the bountiful pleasures of FM classic rock muso awesomeness is to leap headfirst into Boston, episode 127, the Association interview series, episodes 109 to 113, Battle Royale's debut, the Eagles Hotel California LP, which is episode 44, Blind Faith, episode 43, Todd Rundgren with Jonathan Rado at the helm, episodes 37 and 40, Queasy Listening presents William Billy Joel's An Innocent Man, episode 38. Electric Light Orchestra, episodes 34 and 35. The Band with Bob Forrest at the helm, episodes 25 and 27. The Monkees with Andrew Sandoval at the helm, episodes 22 and 23. Badfinger, episode 16. Peter Gabriel, episode 13. Sly and the Family Stone, episodes 5, 6, and 7. And Pink Floyd, episodes 1 and 2. Join us during the upcoming week. This Friday is the Jim Gordon Super episode, and then this Sunday will be a special bonus episode. Kula Shaker's Crispian Mills and Paul Winterhart on the 15 records that shaped the band. And then on Wednesday, you can expect another deliriously sociopathic entry of Rudy Fishman's Podcast Within a Podcast, Discography Soldiers of Sound podcast. And then next Friday, an interview with Roxy Music's Phil Manzanera. Why am I so good to you? Trust me, you're not going to want to miss any of this. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discography.
Osiris.